and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us on Alaska Public Media as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, we're hearing in-depth opinions on the Trump administration and its relationship with the Middle East. Greg Roman, CEO of the Middle East Forum, discusses the U.S.'s current relationship with Middle Eastern countries and how decisions made now can have lasting effects for international relations going forward. This event was sponsored by the Alaska World Affairs Council and took place at 49th State Brewing Company on November 9th. We go now to David Ramser, chair of the board of the Alaska World Affairs Council, with today's introduction.
Greg Roman is the chief operations officer for the Middle East Forum, a Philadelphia-based think tank and advocacy group which promotes what they see as America's interests in the Middle East. Greg previously served as director of the Community Relations Council of the Jewish Federation of Greater Pittsburgh. In 2014, he was named one of the 10 most inspiring global Jewish leaders by the Jewish Telegraphic Agency. He previously served as political advisor to the Deputy Foreign Minister of Israel and worked for the Israeli Minister of Defense. And Mr. Roman is a frequent speaker at venues around the world, often appears on television, and has written for many national publications. And on my quick Google search about Greg, I stumbled across some of his writings, including a piece he wrote at the tail end of the Obama administration headlined, "John Kerry is Dead Wrong About Israeli Settlements." So I'm curious to hear him expand on that and explain current administration's policies. And I just picked up another nugget. He actually lived in Alaska for a little bit, so he'll share that story as well. So please join me in welcoming Greg Roman to our stage.
So we can stand, we can sit, but everybody who just sat down, why don't we all get up? Stretch a little bit. We're going to go through a ride this evening, which is essentially going to take us from the Atlantic Ocean. We often don't see the Atlantic in Alaska. And we're looking on the other side of the polar ice cap there. And then we're going to find ourselves starting in Morocco, making our way through Tunisia, Algeria, Libya, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Oman, Qatar, Yemen, Bahrain, the UAE, Kuwait, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Iran, Turkey, Afghanistan, Pakistan, all the stands I may have missed, except for Stan Goodman. Can I see you out here? Works better with Jewish audiences. But anyway, let's stand up. Let's stretch a little bit. And if anybody ever wants to just get up and stretch, that's fine. Sit back down. So my name is Greg Roman. I'm the director of an organization called the Middle East Forum. We promote American interests in the Middle East and protect American values from threats emanating from that region. However, that's a pretty amorphous way of looking at our organization. What exactly are America's interests in the Middle East? What kind of threats emanate from that region? Some Americans think that the ideological output of the Middle East is beneficial for American interests. Other thinks that it's anathema. Some U.S. presidents prefer to balance America's role in the Middle East. Others prefer to put some countries before others. I hope to do four things for you tonight. The first is to articulate in one way or another a policy that the Trump administration has finally, after 10 months of figuring out who their advisors are going to be, which advisors are going to get indicted, which advisors are going to be promoted, who in the White House, the National Security Council, the Department of Defense, Department of State, and the Department of Homeland Security is responsible for crafting American Middle East policy, and what are their aims? The second thing that we'll try to address is what exactly is the outcome of this policy. What are they trying to achieve, but what are they trying to correct or continue based on the policy of the previous administration, that of President Barack Obama and his key principles on the National Security Council? The third thing that we'll try to address is it's nice for the U.S. to have an agenda, but how is that agenda being received by those actors in the Middle East, whether they be states like Iran, Saudi Arabia, Israel, Iraq, Syria, Turkey, Lebanon, whether they be non-state actors like ISIS or Hezbollah, the Lebanese Shia terrorist organization, or the Taliban, who don't really have a government, but they do have control over a certain amount of territory in Afghanistan. And the fourth thing is that I hope to tell you why this is relevant for Alaska. There is a connection between the Middle East and Alaska, and it's not just oil. I mean, here in North Dakota are the only two places in the United States that are happy when the price of oil goes up. But you have something that's similar with Saudi Arabia and Iran, or in Russia, China to a certain extent. Why is this relevant for you sitting here in Anchorage tonight? Beyond the Alaskan National Guard that's currently serving in Afghanistan, beyond your governor who is in China, right now, I think as we speak, negotiating a potentially $40 billion liquid natural gas terminal that's, I think, a 51% Chinese investment of 49% Alaskan. I might be wrong on that. I'll read the dispatch tomorrow and hear the comments on how I got that wrong. But that's what I hope to get into. So first, the Trump Middle East policy. A lot of people sometimes ask themselves, does Donald Trump have any policies at all beyond the 140 characters that he can put out in a tweet? And yes, he does. The first mistake of any political or policy-based opponent of Donald J. Trump is to think that he does not know what he is doing, to think that the staff around him do not know what they are doing, to think that he acts just from the gut rather than from using his brain. Because if you assume that Trump is just tweeting American foreign policy, you're wrong. Look at the result of what happened in Saudi Arabia just 6 days ago. Donald Trump puts out 140 characters essentially saying that the Saudis, who are now looking at an initial public offering, an IPO, of their state oil company, Aramco, the Arabian American Oil Company, should list that IPO on the New York Stock Exchange. The reason being that American companies and American investors and the standards which are associated with the NYSE should be good enough for the Saudis to put 5% of that company on the market, which will eventually translate to $1 trillion or more, according to expected estimates, for investment that will then go back into Saudi Arabia in the form of a sovereign wealth fund. For those of you who don't know what a sovereign wealth fund is, imagine the boom in Alaskan oil that took place 50 years ago, 60 years ago, maybe the 70s, when what we see in Anchorage now started being built, in the 80s too. You guys took that money, or not you guys, but your government took that money and you put it into certain investment funds. You had capital improvements. You were able to go from a not just tourism-based economy, but one from that was, I don't call it agrarian, but that was mixed in terms of not really relying on hydrocarbon resource-based economic means, and you went to this beautiful, beautiful place that we see right now. The Saudis never did that. They took their money, they put it into building palaces, they put it into building religious institutions, they put it into building cranes that would fall on people. They never actually put it into diversifying their economy. That's the reason why they are on a path right now to do the first initial public offering for any state-owned oil company in the Middle East. And the reason why Trump put it on Twitter, and not in the form of a diplomatic demarche or communication or in a speech, was because this is now the medium through which most world leaders are able to get the most direct messages to the largest amount of audience that they're trying to reach, that generates the most buzz in the media, that's cryptic enough that it leaves it open to interpretation, but is direct enough that it has now become the main outlet for presidential communications. 3 hours after that tweet took place, you saw Saudi stocks skyrocket because Trump had essentially backed it in going in the NYSE. 6 hours after that tweet, it was on Saturday, you saw the prime minister, and somebody's going to look up the tweet now and tell me it's on Sunday. But just think about the general time. 6 hours later, you saw the prime minister of Lebanon sitting in Saudi Arabia resign from his position. 3 hours after that took place, the second largest investor in Twitter, Fox News, Citibank, Prince Alawid bin Talal, was arrested by the Saudi government for corruption. The head of the Saudi National Guard was arrested for corruption. The head of the NBC, the largest broadcaster in Saudi Arabia, corruption. Former intelligence ministers, governors, the head of the Saudi royal court, the head of the Saudi royal, not just the court, but justice system, all arrested. 209 individual Saudis arrested within 48 hours of a Trump tweet. On the other side, a day later, you had a missile launched at Saudi Arabia's capital, intercepted by an American anti-missile launcher, a Patriot PAC-3. We'll get to Iran in a little bit. But the end of this story is that 5 days before that tweet went out, Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, and a man named Mohammed bin Salman, the number two in the Saudi ruling family, were able to put together a plan that took advantage of the way that Trump communicates best through digital diplomacy and the way in which the Saudis communicate best, which is through essentially monarchical purges. The Saudis through power, Trump through Twitter. But what happened as a result of this was a very well-orchestrated, step-by-step plan to bring the United States and Saudi Arabia closer together, whether it be economically, whether it be militarily, whether it be on intelligence sharing, whether it be on the aim to have a new generation of Saudi leaders. And it was all done in a series of a few days, in a series of late-night meetings that took place between the president's son-in-law and the king's son. So when you see a Trump tweet, sometimes it may just because he gets really upset watching Fox and Friends. Another time might be because it's part of an international strategy to change the way that regional politics work. Do not undermine, do not underthink, do not underestimate President Trump or his team. Now, the context of this story goes back to the second question, which is, what are the effects? What do people in the region think about this policy that President Trump is trying to implement? And where do we get there? In 2008, President Barack Obama ran on a platform of unifying the country, not just in terms of being able to find our way out of 5 years of a morass in Iraq and 7 years of conflict in Afghanistan, but also fundamentally trying to change the way that Americans understood their relationship with the Middle East, whether it be militarily, economically, religiously, culturally, ideologically. Because since 1960, since the end of Eisenhower's term and the beginning of JFK in the presidency, in the White House, the United States has had a policy of putting its friends first as it relates to its neighbors in the Middle East. We see that with the Aswan Dam. We saw that with the decoupling of Egypt from the Soviet Union after the Yom Kippur War in 1973. We saw that with the Americans becoming the principal arms supplier to Israel after the French boycott that took place in 66 and 67. You saw that in terms of America's relationship, even going back before JFK, with Roosevelt sitting down with King Al-Aziz or Faisal, I forget which one he was sitting down with, at the Yalta conference. You saw that the Americans were trying, country by country, to become the principal hegemonic actor, the sole occupier of power in the relationship between it and the other countries that had then sort of fallen to the wayside after World War II. At one time, Iran was a satellite of England. Iraq was a country that was having a king that was appointed by the United Kingdom. Syria and Lebanon were vassal states of France. Russia had a pretty good relationship after the Russo-Crimean War with Turkey, even going to the point where it backed the communists in the Turkish Civil War that took place in 46-47. The United States became the principal actor that replaced those different countries' security in 1960 and 1961. The Middle East essentially became a bulwark against the spread of communism, except for a few countries that became members of what was then called the Non-Aligned Movement. This policy continued through the 70s, 80s, and 90s. You are all probably familiar with some of the wars that took place. The Turkish occupation of Cyprus in 1974, the Gulf War that took place in 91, the invasion or not the invasion, but the U.S. Troop presence that took place in Lebanon after the first Lebanon war with Israel in 1982, and the subsequent results of American action there, whether it was the bombing of the U.S. Marine barracks, the bombings of the U.S. embassy in Beirut, not once, but twice, I think it was 83 and 84. You saw the U.S. being the subject of terrorist attacks to the Khobar bombings after the Gulf War. And eventually, we get to the mid-90s, when the U.S. is never really involved in a direct kinetic confrontation, a direct military confrontation with another state in the Middle East. Except there's this organization called Al-Qaeda, an outgrowth of the U.S. support for the Mujahideen, for the holy, their martyrs, or whatever you want to call it. And it wasn't a direct outgrowth of U.S. support for the individuals who were the Arabs who actually went to Afghanistan to fight against the Soviet Union in the 80s. It was sort of a parallel growth. The ability for the U.S. to supply fighters in Afghanistan to fight against the Soviet Union, acting essentially as American proxies by way of Pakistan, acting as a middleman to arm those Mujahideen in Afghanistan, gave these fighters the confidence to be able to fight against not a Western actor, but a much larger hegemonic actor. And by doing that, those who fought together from 1980 to 1988 became what was then the core of the terrorist entities that would then go fight back against the United States about a decade later. So what happened in August of 2000? Does anyone remember? An attack against a U.S. naval warship in Yemen called the USS Cole. That was the last attack that took place against American military targets during the Clinton administration. You had bombings of embassies, you had bombings of barracks, you had the bombing of the World Trade Center, if you remember the first bombing of the World Trade Center. And all these disparate attacks were never really understood by the American people to be the actions that were inspired by one man, Osama bin Laden. But then we became familiar with that name only 6 months into the Bush administration. When on September 11th, 2001, we saw the towers fall, we saw the Pentagon hit, we saw Shanksville, Pennsylvania, Flight 93, I think, crash out of the sky because of heroic actors that fought back. It was the first time that American citizens directly fought back against Al-Qaeda, not using cruise missiles or larger kinetic weapons dropped by, you know, F-15s, F-16s, or B-52s. And after that, America sort of woke up. But it didn't wake up to attacks that all of a sudden had transpired on 9/11. There had been Al-Qaeda-oriented attacks against U.S. targets since the late 80s. And we as a government, or we as a people, weren't ignorant necessarily of that fact, but we never were really able to identify the enemy. And then you have, in the aftermath of 9/11, George Bush, the president then, not declaring a war against Al-Qaeda, but declaring a war against a tactic, not the root cause of why those attacks took place in the United States. A war against terrorism is nice to declare. It sounds good. The optics are good, at least in terms of politically. It was the much needed response that, to bring that cathartic feeling of being able to form a national unity against an entity. But it wasn't a national war against Al-Qaeda. It wasn't a national war against the Taliban. It was this amorphous concept of terrorism. And that was the first failure in the U.S.'s response to what I would call the rise of violent Islamism, not Islam. Islam is a religion, a peaceful religion. Over 85% of its practitioners deserve to be respected and should be members of any society where Islam is there. It's great. Christianity, monotheism, Judaism, Buddhism, Hinduism, it's all the same. Islamism is the political outgrowth which is manipulated by radicals within that faith, just like there are radicals within other world religions, and take advantage of the advents and the teaching of it to try to then use it as justification for the use of mass violence to achieve political means. So the ideology of Islamism used a tactic of terrorism, 9/11, other attacks, to push its means forward. But the U.S. never identified Islamism as its enemy. It identified terrorism as a tactic of what it tried to fight back against. And this is the same thing that happened in 2003 with Iraq. The U.S. decided to adopt a strategy of warfare to remove a dictator, which was, yes, supporting terrorists who were counterintuitive to American interests in that region. It did cause the Iranians to drop their nuclear program. But the 7 years of conflict that took place under the Bush administration after 9/11 never really had any strategic goals. There was no thought of what would take place after Afghanistan was invaded. There was no thought of what would take place after Iraq was invaded. When you had Obama come into power, he wasn't dealing with the aftermath of the lack of strategy in the region, because I think at the end of the Bush administration, the appointment of David Petraeus to have the surge against al-Qaeda in Iraq, against the Fedayeen, against other remnants of the Ba'athist regime was actually starting to work. Iraq was on the precipice of great success in 2007 and 2008. But instead of the United States doubling down in Iraq when Obama came to power, he saw it to be his job to remove U.S. forces without the job being done. The same thing was in Afghanistan. The U.S. and its NATO allies had approximately control of 90% of Afghanistan at the end of the Bush administration. Bush also realized there that he didn't deploy the amount of forces needed to be able to successfully not just defeat the Taliban, but also to give the Afghan government the time it took to be able to redevelop its own army, its own institutions, so that the U.S. would not have to guarantee or be a guarantor of Afghani security. And Obama's campaign promise was in 2008, we will remove our troops from Afghanistan by date X. The same thing took place with Guantanamo Bay. We will close Guantanamo Bay, but we won't necessarily tell you what's going to happen with the individuals who are there. So these three things, the inability to define the enemy that took place after 9/11 under Bush, the desire to remove U.S. forces from Afghanistan and Iraq and other places in the Middle East at during the campaign of Barack Obama, and the inability to define not just what our strategy was, but what were the outcomes of what we were trying to get, led us to today to Trump's Middle East policy. On a tactical level, how much time do we have left for this? Because I could talk about this for the next 4 hours. It's already 6:30. All right, we'll try to do like 5 minutes. Okay. So the failure of the Bush administration was defining the enemy, was defining a strategy, defining outcomes. The failure of the Obama administration was trying to achieve something called hegemonic equilibrium. And we talked a little bit about this today at the school. Let's dig into that a little bit. What's a hegemony? It's when you have an actor that has a certain amount of polar, political, military, intelligence, cultural, economic control over an area beyond its borders, right? China, arguably, is the hegemon of North Korea, Vietnam, some other areas in Southeast Asia. The Monroe Doctrine allows the United States to be the sole hegemon in North America, maybe to a certain extent over South America. No one can intervene in the hemispheric affairs of North and South America without the U.S. giving its blessing. The EU is the hegemon not just for the area within the continental Europe, but also for many of the areas in North Africa, to a certain extent parts of Eastern Europe, which are not part of the EU. Look at the Balkans. Barack Obama thought that the role of the U.S. as its hegemon concerning the Middle East, specifically Sunni Arab states in the Middle East, from Morocco to the Gulf, was not the role that the U.S. should be playing in that region. What he thought was that instead of supporting Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Israel and Morocco, he had to be able to find a balance between countries in that region, regardless of their history of violence and incitement against the United States. That's where we get the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iran deal. That's where we get the United States embrace of Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the Islamist dictator of Turkey. That's where we get the U.S.'s support for certain Arab Spring revolts that deposed decade-long U.S. allies like Hosni Mubarak in Egypt and saw it replaced with organizations and their leadership who were directly counteracting the ideas that the U.S. stands for and that its allies stand for, like Mohammed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood. And even when the U.S. had the opportunity to intervene in democratic revolutions against tyrannical regimes, it didn't address the red line that the president had set in Syria with the use of chemical weapons and Ghouta, I can't even pronounce it. When Assad used chemical weapons against his own people, Obama said that he would have struck and destroyed all the chemical weapons. He ended up entering into an agreement with the Russians instead. And even in June of 2009, when there was the Green Revolution that took place in Iran after the rigged election of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad in his second term as the president of Iran, Obama was silent. We remember that iconic picture of that woman wearing the hijab, protesting in the streets of Tehran, the Iranian capital, looking up, seeing a sniper on a rooftop, a member of the Iranian Basij, their paramilitary militia, and getting shot through the eye. It was as if though the people of Iran were looking up for America for its guidance and received a bullet instead. So the purpose of this, that was like a good analogy, right? I just came up with that one right now. So essentially what this was that the U.S. said that we are no longer going to be the protector of the Middle East allies that we have held dear for the last five decades. We are going to try to find balance in the region, because our school of international affairs, our school of international relations theory, says that the way to be able to have peace in a region and when everyone's interests are secured and they are moderated. So Iran, we will pursue sanctions against you, but we will do it to a point where we try to bring you to the table to suspend your program, rather than the nuclear program, rather than try to eliminate it. We will listen to the people of Egypt rather than listen to the government of Egypt, because we think the people know better than the government. We will go to the Saudis and we will say we will no longer supply you with American weaponry, at least not to the level of what we did in the past, because we think you're using it to stoke conflict against Iran. And we will offer an embrace to the Islamists in Turkey, because we will attempt to try to make nice with a NATO ally, even though all the actions of Turkey are directly countering our interests in that region. And then we even get to the Israelis, and we'll talk about that op-ed I wrote for the LA Times, why John Kerry is dead wrong on the settlements. The settlements are a symptom of the problems between the Israelis and the Palestinians. In the first, I think, 8 months of the administration after the election of Barack Obama, the appointment of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, the U.S. government appointed a special envoy that asked the Israelis unilaterally to suspend settlement construction. The way I see settlements is that they're Jewish towns in the West Bank. The way that the international community sees them is that they're illegally placed there because they consider it to be an occupied territory. Call it disputed territory, but we don't have to get into details. But the action of asking Israel to take a unilateral step to incentivize the Palestinians to come to the table to negotiate was emblematic of this idea of balance. Israel, you give, and the Palestinians, they will also give. However, Obama disregarded 50 years of Israeli-Palestinian peacemaking attempts, or war-making attempts, depending on how you look at it. Every time that Israel gives, the Palestinians take. The same thing with the Iranians. Every time America gave an inch, the Iranians took an entire foot. So after that 9-month settlement freeze, and I was actually in the Army unit, it's an amazing story. And the capabilities of the United States, not just in wartime, but in peace, are quite apt to tell you how serious this president was. How much is this? Does anybody here an aerospace engineer or work for a defense contractor that works with satellites? Anybody? Those spy satellites that are in the sky probably cost $800 million, a billion, $2 billion. They have nuclear engines that help them run. The U.S. was using spy satellites to look at the contours of the topography of Israeli settlements. And they said, here's a black line. This is where the settlements were prior to the implementation of the freeze. And then they would come in every month to our office and say, this is a red line. This is where your settlement expanded its boundaries. The U.S. was investing significant intelligence assets from the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency to determine where Israelis were building their homes. They weren't using it to monitor the movements of Palestinian militant organizations. They weren't using it to try to monitor the shipments that were going in at that time to the Palestinians to arm Gaza, Hamas in Gaza or other disparate entities. They were using it to track home construction. But because of that, we knew, at least when I was in the Israeli Ministry of Defense, that America was serious. And the last thing that the Israeli government wants to do is to anger the President of the United States. So they played ball. So over that 9-10 month period during the freeze, how many times did the Prime Minister of Israel and the President of the Palestinian Authority meet? Once. For 20 minutes, I think in the last month of that freeze. And what did Israel get out of it? It delayed home construction for 10 months. What did the Palestinians get out of it? A diplomatic victory by again rejecting the Zionist regime. And this was repeated year after year after year. There was three wars that took place between the Israelis and Palestinians during that time. And it was always the United States that saw to broker a balance between the two rather than putting its greater ally, Israel, first. So, like I said, this policy is where the Trump administration was dealing with. But there was an unintended consequence of President Obama and his national security team trying to balance the region by trying to put Iran on the same level of Israel. Turkey is the same level as Saudi Arabia. The Qataris on the same level of Jordan. The non-intervention in Syria, the non-intervention in Iran. And what it did was it showed that America's regional allies were better off working together when they had once upon a time been enemies, to be able to act as a block in their relationship with the United States rather than acting as individual nations trying to form bilateral alliances with the United States. So here comes January 2017. President Obama leaves office, goes back to, I think he moved to a house in Washington or Chicago, Kalorama. They're neighbors with the Kushners. And you have President Trump arrive, and no one has any idea what his policy is. We have these talks about a Muslim ban. We have these talks about moving the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. We have talks of scrapping the Iran deal. But none of these things have actually happened yet. And the reason why is because when President Trump was at his inauguration, he ran into an invisible wall called the Fourth Estate. That of the middle management of U.S. national security making. And those people who were promising those policies, whether it was National Security Advisor Flynn, fired, pending indictment. Whether it was the chief strategist, Steve Bannon, fired. Whether it was the national security spokesperson, Sebastian Gorka, fired. Who survived? Those individuals who had previously served in U.S. government national security positions. And I think that the team that Trump has around him now, Kelly, Mattis, Tillerson was never in U.S. government, but he effectively worked for a non-state actor when he was, how many times did Tillerson come up here to Alaska? Not a good bit. He's a pretty wise guy, not a wise guy, but he's a smart guy. He's has experience in international relations, a good appointment. And what they did was they were embraced by the bureaucracies that they were put on top as political nominees to represent those traditional positions that were like Kennedy, like Carter, like Nixon, so on and so forth, Reagan, Bush, Clinton, Bush. And they took advantage of the proximity and the closeness that developed between unlikely allies. Saudi Arabia, back in 2002, before the Saudi peace initiative with Israel, was sending $25,000 to the families of every Palestinian suicide bomber who blew himself up in Israel. Qatar, small Gulf nation there on the Persian Gulf, now at odds with the rest of their former friends in the Gulf Cooperation Council, supplied Hamas with billions of dollars, hosted the head of Hamas in their capital. Turkey, a U.S. ally, presumptively, is now buying Chinese and Russian anti-air missiles. Obama embraced them. Trump rejected. Obama had embraced Iran. Trump rejects it. And by doing so, you now have Trump forming alliances between all those disparate actors who felt ignored by Obama, and they're coming back into the American hegemonic fold. So I guess we're pretty much 5 minutes? Okay. We don't have time for questions, though, right? Okay. And I don't know how long we have the space, but I'll go over. I'll stay here all night if you'd like me to. But in essence, Trump inherited a policy that had unintended consequences and is now taking advantage of that closeness between Israel and Saudi Arabia, between Jordan and Egypt, who were not really on speaking terms. I haven't touched on Syria, but this is maybe a bold statement. You might not like it, but the Syrian civil war has been won by Bashar al-Assad and the Russians. One of the unintended consequences of Trump's new strategy in that area, that arc between Lebanon, Syria, northern Iraq, and Iran, is that the drive and the obsession to defeat ISIS militarily created a political vacuum that has been filled not by U.S. allies, but by Iran. There's a picture of Qassem Soleimani, the head of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. It's Al-Quds Division, which is essentially the external paramilitary organization that tries to institute Iranian policy abroad, with armored personnel vehicles and M1A1 American tanks, M1A1 Abrams American tanks, Soleimani standing next to it, pointing up at the air, looking at FA-18 fighter jets, providing cover for Iranian-backed Shia militias fighting against Kurds. The Kurds being the best U.S. allies in Syria and in Iraq. We are almost in, as Superman would call it, bizarro world. We have our, if anybody likes Superman, we now have those individuals that we thought were our friends being attacked by the people that we think are our enemies, but we're providing the firepower, the logistics, the ammunition, the political cover for that to take place. So while Trump may have inherited what I would think is any kind of policymaker's dream of returning to a successful American Middle East policy, there's a very long way to go. Three things that I would make recommendations, and then we can go towards questions. The way that Trump and his administration treats the Middle East should be not like that of Bush, not like that of Obama, but I think the better example would be that like Lyndon Johnson. He showed that he was willing to use U.S. force to provide armaments, to supply material, to supply personnel, but also to have a value-based policy. We're not talking about Vietnam here. That's way, 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 way far away. I'm not even going to get into that. A Middle East guy. Stop at Pakistan. Don't know anything else about those guys. But the way that Johnson executed his Middle East policy was starting with what Kennedy, or continuing with what Kennedy had done, by having a relationship with this guy named Lev Yeshkol. He called him his little Jew. Don't mean that in a pejorative way. That's how Johnson, if you know the history of Lyndon Johnson, his little Jewish friend. And Yeshkol would go to the White House. I think he visited 3-4 times. I don't think Johnson actually ever visited Israel. Correct me if I'm wrong. But they would have a discussion about how Johnson yearned for his time in Texas. He yearned for his time. I think he graduated from a teacher's college. All of this politics was too big for him. Even when he announced that he wasn't running for re-election, one of his closest friends was still Yeshkol, because this was in the aftermath of the Six-Day War, which saw Israel's borders expand fourfold. And they were able to have a relationship that was between people, not the enmity that existed between political opponents, where President Obama treated Netanyahu as a political enemy, not as a strategic enemy. But that same relationship that exists between or existed between Yeshkol and Johnson is sort of like the relationship that exists right now between senior officials in the White House and their Middle East counterparts. Mohammed bin Salman, a Wahhabist Muslim, Sunni Muslim in Saudi Arabia, according to media reports, whenever the Jewish negotiator for Middle East peace, Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, but let's remove the son-in-law part, meets with senior Saudi officials, it's as if though the gang's back together again. They stay up till 4 in the morning, swapping stories, discussing strategy, having tea. There's a certain element of personal diplomacy that one might expect in being able to share war stories when you're trying to close a business deal that now exists between those leaders. And just that personal connection is very different from the formality and the bureaucracy that existed under the Obama administration and the sort of high-headedness that existed under President Bush. So personal is beneficial to political. The second thing that I think is something that Trump has to look out for is not to be caught up in the day-to-day actions that take place in the Middle East and the obsession to accomplish a goal, but to go back to that original failure of George Bush to define who the enemy is. And I think they started with that back at a conference that took place in late April. Does everyone remember Trump looking like he's on a witch's orb or a witch's cauldron? And there's that light that's there, and you have all these other Arab leaders around him. And he declares in Riyadh, in the same capital that rules Mecca and Medina, the two holiest Muslim cities, "You must disconnect from Hamas. You must get close to Israel. We will support you, but you must support them." Direct messages using symbolism are very, very significant in the Arab world. So he's getting personal, and he knows how to be symbolic, so long as he doesn't make a wrong tweet about it afterwards. And the third thing that I think that Trump has to do is he has to start realizing that there is an enemy of today, but there's also the potential for them to be a friend of tomorrow. There's no strategy for how to help the Kurds out. There's no distancing of the U.S. with Turkey beyond canceling the issuance of visas. There is bluster about canceling the Iran deal, but there's no thought about what you do the day after if you cancel it. So they need more long-term thinking. They don't have to think like generals, which is pretty much who comprises three-quarters of the national security principles of the United States. Besides Mike Pompeo and the CIA and Tillerson and the State Department, you have three generals running American national security policy. There's a reason why we instituted security control, civilian control, with the Constitution back when Washington, even though he was a general, but when we had I'm going to forget the letter here, with the advent of the National Security Council back with the National Security Act that created a Pentagon and the reorganization of the military and Joint Chiefs of Staff. We have to go back to the original thinking of the late 40s, that we don't need generals telling us what to do with our national security policy. We need civilians who are able to actually rebuild after the war is over. It was the mistake of Obama. He wanted withdrawal. It was the mistake of Bush. He wanted defeat. Trump has to learn how to rebuild, reconnect, get personal, get businesslike, think of what individuals need, and then I think you'll have a more coherent Trump-America-Middle East policy. Without taking those things into account, I'm afraid we might repeat the previous mistakes of the last 16 years. So I'm going to end there.
You are listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage. We've been hearing from Greg Roman, CEO of the Middle East Forum. He's been discussing the current administration and its interactions with countries in the Middle East. This event was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council and recorded on November 9th. We return to the second half of the program, where we'll hear questions from the audience.
So I want to thank you very much for a very thoughtful and thought-provoking discussion. And, you know, finding some layers of hope to actually believe that there is coherent policy actually being generated, or at least the possibility thereof. I'm actually kind of interested in it from the other side of things, that is, in terms of Israel or the Palestinians in particular, how are they reacting to these sorts of things? Are there major changes to be expected from that quarter, or are we kind of destined for more of the same?
So I was sitting with a senior Israeli diplomat about 3 weeks ago, and he said to me, "Greg, I have no idea what this president expects of us. At least with Obama, we knew what we were getting. With Trump, it's as if though he has a wild card. Yeah, he said he would move the embassy to Jerusalem. That hasn't happened yet. He said that he would hold the Palestinian Authority to account. That hasn't happened. But I think what the Israelis need to realize is that the strategy that Trump is pursuing is that of a multilateral deal involving Egypt, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, even Morocco to a certain extent, that takes into account Israel's well-being as a collective of those groups of U.S. allies, treating all of them as a bloc, like I said, rather than having that bilateral U.S.-Israel relationship. Now, that doesn't mean that the U.S. absconds from, or you say litalem in Hebrew, like to push off from the Reuven. Where's Reuven? Litalem. Ech nitargem et zeh. Yeah. to like shrug off, right? Kaha. Okay. So it's not like the U.S. is like forgetting about the importance of the bilateral relationship. But what they're doing is they're putting more importance on multilateral relationships. And I think Israel has to adjust to that. The Palestinians, on the other hand, they are the odd man out. You have the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia. By the way, an interesting fact about him. The reason why Saudis like this Crown Prince is because he's like more than half the country. He's 32. You have a millennial monarch in power right now in Saudi Arabia. And as opposed to other millennials in this country, who some people call the worst generation, I don't think so. I think we're a great group. We're going by Jimmy Kimmel and their Twitter feeds, whatever. But you have a millennial in the Middle East who knows what he wants. And the Palestinians, after the resignation of the Lebanese prime minister, after the call to remove all Saudis from Lebanon, the Kuwaitis followed up shortly thereafter, summoned the president of the Palestinian Authority to Saudi Arabia. What kind of president are you if you're summoned to another foreign capital? So the Palestinians, they are in a tizzy about what to do. You have a American United Nations ambassador who's holding them accountable. You have a Congress with the backing of the Trump administration that's about to pass a law saying that Palestinian terrorists can no longer be given salaries. It's an absurd system that the Palestinians have. If you go and steal a car and you get a 3-year prison sentence, you get a 1,000 shekel, about a $250 pension per month. If you attempt an attack against an Israeli and you get a 10-year prison sentence, you get about $1,000 a month. And if you're actually able to kill Israelis in a massive use of mass violence for political means, and you get a life sentence, you get $4,000 a month. Who's paying this from the Palestinian Authority coffers? You, the American taxpayers, are subsidizing the salaries of terrorists. And Congress is trying to stop that practice. So the Palestinians don't know what to do. The Israelis are just confused. So,
I'm interested in your take on Turkey and which direction you see it headed in the next, say, 10 years.
1 year ago, on October 17th, 2016, even before that, on July 15th of 2016, there was an alleged coup d'etat by the Turkish military against the president of Turkey, Erdogan, and his party, the AKP, the Justice and Development Party. Erdogan placed the blame for that coup squarely on the shoulders of an ailing Turkish cleric living in the Pocono Mountains. It's where all Pennsylvanians go to ski when they can't afford Vermont or Aspen or Alaska. You got guys good skiing here? Anyway, so there's this ailing cleric sitting in some estate in the Poconos of outside Philadelphia, and he was responsible for the use of F-16s to bomb the presidential palace, for the deployment of Turkish military tanks along the bridges crossing the Bosphorus Strait. And his movement was called Hizmet, or as the Turks refer to it, F-E-T-O, the Fethullah Gulen Terrorist Organization. Turkey used this opportunity to arrest diplomats, members of the military. 5,000 college deans were fired. 30,000 teachers were fired. Tens of thousands of government employees were fired. All the main Kurdish opposition leaders that are active in southeast Turkey, now in jail. Turkey has the most amount of journalists in prison of any country. They're supposed to be a democracy. They're a member of NATO. Turkey has effectively changed from an Islamist democracy that was there until they're changed with the constitution to now a full-blown dictatorship ruled by emergency decree. Obama's response was, thank God you weren't overthrown. President Trump's response was to meet with him in the White House for 22 minutes in, I think it was March or April of this year. The Turks have done four what I consider to be grave injustices against American citizens and American interests in the region. The first, a man named Andrew Brunson on October 17th of 2016, an American pastor of a small Presbyterian church in a city called Izmir, Izmir is the third largest city in Turkey, was arrested for allegedly being part of this vast Islamic conspiracy against the president of Turkey. He's a pastor from Oklahoma. What is he doing being connected to terrorists? Come on. Can't even speak Turkish. Two, the Turkish government visited the United States back in, I think it was April of this year, and severely injured over 30 protesters that were outside the Turkish embassy residence by members of their presidential personnel guard and have subsequently been indicted by the U.S. Attorney in Washington, D.C. The third thing that they did was the same event happened in New York City when Erdogan went to go speak to the General Assembly and to an association of Turks. The last thing that I think, which is probably the most absurd thing that they've done, is if you're a member of a NATO country, you have an expectation. Anyone in the military here? Anyone served in NATO or a NATO command? You're fighting with Estonians and Latvians and Germans and British. You have the same kind of ammunition. You have the same kind of armaments. You have interoperability between all of your different arms. You have the ability for a joint command, right? Turks are now buying weapons from the Russians. Not just any weapons, their principal anti-air and anti-missile defense systems. They are basically in bed with Putin. They're agreeing with the Syrians. They're working with the Chinese, and they're getting close to the Iranians. They're bombing American allies in North Iraq. They're suppressing minorities that I think is counterintuitive to a democracy to do in northern Syria. They're supporting Hamas, a terrorist organization that's killed both Israelis and American citizens, all at the same time demanding that Americans play ball. And what happened on September at a police ceremony, a police academy graduation in Istanbul, Erdogan said, we are not holding Mr. Andrew Parson for any terrorism-related crimes. We are holding him as a political prisoner. So you, the United States government, will ship back that ailing cleric in the Poconos and we'll have a hostage exchange. What kind of American ally uses American religious figures to try to enter into political negotiations? There's another 11 Americans that are being held by the Turks. That's in addition to German journalists, the head of Amnesty International in Istanbul, so on and so forth. So I think it's despicable the way that the Turkish, this is your question, not yours, but we see each other nodding, so we like that. But it's despicable what the Turkish government is doing, and I think there's no mechanism to kick a country out of NATO, but everything should be done to isolate Turkey until they reform their ways. And if they want to be with the Russians, let them.
As one of Jewish heritage, I don't think Trump cares one bit about Israel or the Jews. I mean, he does have a Jewish son-in-law, a daughter that converted, and he surrounded himself by anti-Semites in the White House. How do you feel about that? I just don't think he cares.
I've been to the White House 13 times since the election of Donald Trump and other government offices. I have not detected 1 ounce of anti-Semitism or anti-Israel attitude from any of those officials. Now, the responses to domestic incidents that took place, Charlottesville, that heinous attack, saying both sides, I'm not a domestic analyst, but as a Jew, I find that deplorable. However, in terms of foreign policy and as its relationship with Israel, you couldn't have a better president for the nation state of Israel. And I'm not saying that because I'm some kind of a sycophant that backs the president. I wrote an article in March of 2016 saying why Israelis should be concerned about Donald Trump as president. And I admit that I was wrong in some of the assessments that I made in that article. Those things didn't come true. I wrote another article in the Albany Times Union in June of 2016 that said, no, Mr. Trump, all Americans are not racist. I think that the way that the administration's evolved, it's in a pretty good place. I also wrote another article, for full disclosure, defending Sebastian Gorka and the Jewish Forward, the main newspaper that was attacking him, after I had the opportunity to sit with him for a couple days on end doing some policy work. So I'm not going to tell you that there is not any actors within that administration that have a certain amount of disfavor on an individual level. But I will tell you that there are American Jews that work for President Trump, and they're not shilling for him. They think that he's the person that's going to best be able to carry out policies that is not good for Israel. When I think of foreign policy, I first think what's good for America. And it's reflected in my writings, my policy recommendations, my testimony on the Hill. When I'm in the United States, I'm an American. When I'm in Israel, I'm still an American. So that's my take. And I'm not trying to come up here saying he's God's gift to the earth. But at the same time, I'm saying that versus where we could have been, or a little better off now?
I'm not holding my breath.
That's all right. And I would love to be proven wrong.
No pressure. No pressure. You've alluded to the friendly relationship between the U.S. and the Kurds. Should the U.S. have supported Kurdish independence?
No. The U.S. should have encouraged Barzani and Talabani, the two heads of the – one's dead and one resigned now. This is like right after that independence vote. They should have told them to be able to get more concessions from the central Iraqi government. One thing that the Kurds lacked after they defeated ISIS in northern Iraq was a strategy to be able to get independence. They thought that they could short-circuit the regional order, ignoring a very, very large Turkish army to their north, a large Iranian army to their east, a Russian-backed army to their west, and an American-backed army to their south. However, once they declared independence, you know, it's like a two-part question. What would I have said before that referendum, and what would I have said afterwards? I think that the Americans should have backed the Kurds to the hilt. It's not because I think that they should just be backing the Kurds. I think America should be doing everything possible to stop the spread of Iranian influence from the Iranian-Iraqi border all the way to the Mediterranean Sea. So now the Kurds are in a little bit of a tizzy, but even the Kurds can't agree on what the Kurds want. You have the KDP, the Kurdish Democratic Party, and the PUK, the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, who can't agree on what to do in terms of the operations in Erbil. The Kurds constitute three regions there in the north. You have the Syrian Kurds, which are Marxists, the PYD and the YPG, who can't agree on how they want to split northeastern Syria. You have the PKK, the Kurdish terror group in southeast Turkey, who can't agree with the elected Kurdish parliamentarians, many of whom are now in Turkish jail, doing there. And the Iranian Kurds are making tons of money on smuggling oil and other illicit goods across the Kandil mountain range that's between whatever mountain range is over there between the Iranian and Iraqi border, and they're having a grand old time making money off of it. So the Kurds are in a little bit of a pickle right now. I think the best way forward for them is to recalibrate, enter into negotiations with the central government in Baghdad, reaffirm themselves. The Kurds are attracting a lot of foreign investment right now in a lot of the oil fields that they still control. They lost about 40% of Iraqi oil fields control when they were kicked out of Kirkuk by the Shabiha, by the Iranian-backed Iraqi popular militia there. So they have to rethink what exactly they want. You know, the symbolic declaration of independence for the Kurds is not always going to be the way. You know, the short way isn't always the easiest way. Sometimes the long way is the way that they're actually going to be able to get what they want. Kurds have to be able to agree with themselves before they can start asserting their, you know, sovereignty and autonomy to other actors who are much larger and stronger than they are.
Okay, let's give Greg one more round of applause.
Thank you for listening to Addressing Alaskans today on Alaska Public Media. We've just finished hearing questions presented to Greg Roman, former director of the Community Relations Council of the Jewish Federation of Greater Pittsburgh and CEO of the Middle East Forum. I'm your host and producer for Addressing Alaskans, Eric Bork, for KSKA Anchorage.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. The views expressed are those of the hosts and participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.